Dear listeners, welcome to Faces of Digital Health, a podcast about digital health and how healthcare systems around the world adopt technology, with me, Tiasza Zajc. One of the more visible news in digital health in July in Europe was that, according to Sifted, healthcare seed investments in Europe surpassed fintech investments in June. This made the health tech industry the industry that's attracting most investments at the moment. At the same time, in the US, Rock Health reported that digital health startups in the US raised $10.3 billion in the first half of 2022, which was less than last year, and Startup Health reported a lower amount of investments on the global level compared to 2021. $16 billion were raised in Q1 and Q2, which is less than in the first half of 2021, but still much more than in the first half of the year of 2020. You can tune in to a reflection about the current state of digital health globally by listening to the interview with the Startup Health president, Unity Stokes, which was published in April. I will add the link to the show notes. But today, we're going to take a look at the European market and also talk about the rising problem of digital visual stress. This refers to various problems that are on the rise because of the increasing screen time. The speakers you will hear from today are Simon Molitor, Associate Project Manager at AescuVest, a VC firm in Europe, and Michael Mrochen, who is a member of the investment committee at the AescuVest, and also the CEO of Vivior, which is a digital health startup that offers a novel wearable device which objectively measures visual behavior prior to vision correction interventions. This episode is supported by EIT Health Germany. EIT Health Germany is one of the 8 knowledge and innovation communities currently funded by the European Institute of Innovation and Technology, EIT. EIT Health Germany connects 150 renowned partners from the industry, research and education from Germany, Austria and Switzerland. If you're a startup working in the field of digital health or biotech and don't know EIT Health Germany yet, I would encourage you to visit eit-health.de, that's eit-health.de, where you'll find more about innovation, acceleration and education programs. Now let's dive into today's discussion. Simon, Michael, welcome. I want to start this discussion with the current atmosphere around digital health investments in Europe. Based on data by Dealroom, Sifted recently reported that in Europe, investments in health tech surpassed fintech investments in June. So that was quite a big news. And I wonder, what's your observation of the digital health space in the last year or two? Because in the US and globally, Rock Health and Startup Health detected a decline in funding in the first half of 2021 compared to 2022 compared to 2021. So maybe, Michael, do you want to start? You've got quite a lot of investment experiences.
Yeah, thank you. I think my view is digital health was a little bit as a, pretty much I would say that before pandemic time and during pandemic, now in the after pandemic time, hopefully. And I think the pre-pandemic time, I think everyone was understanding that changes have to come, but it was just hard to justify clinicians and the users to get into it. And I think, for lack of better terms, with the help of the pandemic, I think healthcare professionals understood the benefits of getting into digital health from various positions, starting from the communication with the patients, starting from simple appointment making with patients, towards supporting them via telemedicine, towards then also getting into data, access to data from all, not only from their office. So I think that drove a big momentum over the last 3 years and during the pandemic time. And like with every hype probably, I think we also learned where it is really helpful, where it has really impact. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is really the realistic pathways of where does it really help and where it has really its benefits today. And I'm still sure in the future we're going to learn more on that pathway.
Simon, what's your perspective? Do you want to add anything to what Michael said?
Sure. Just to add on that, I think one important aspect that we shouldn't forget here is also the macro economy outside of healthcare. Take a step back and also look at the world economy and what's happening there. And then it makes sense also that we see some data that is declining here and there, because that's just what happens throughout every sector right now. So we cannot say that, for example, healthcare or every other sector is performing bad right now, because everything is performing bad right now. And there is still a lot of money out there, and we can also feel this as a venture capital firm, but investors are a little bit more, they were scared a little bit more, let's put it that way, than the past 2 years. Because right now the world economy is not, there's not too much certainty around like it was in the last 2 years, maybe. And therefore we might see a little decline and a slowdown or something, but it would never change our view as SQVest as well on where digital health and healthcare in general is moving in the next 10 or 20 years as a long-term investor.
You described SQVest as a VC, but that's not how the company is usually described. So on the website, you describe yourself as a fintech company with a special focus on financing digital healthcare solutions. You're known as the crowdfunding equity platform. So can you explain a little bit about how exactly do you operate as a VC compared to other VCs? How do you differentiate on the VC landscape?
That's a very good question and an important one, because we need to position SQVest here at the right spot. You've been talking about the crowd investing part, which is our past, right? So it's not SQVest what it is today. We don't do any crowd investing anymore. SQVest was founded in 2014 and we had quite a journey there. And we did crowd investing for quite some time. And we made the decision to move away from crowd investing to more institutional investors. And we've been very successful with this pivot already. We are very sure that this was the right decision. And I'm saying venture capital firm because that's what we do. We do venture capital investments, which are just the investments we do in this stage the company is in. But you're right, we're not a classical venture capital fund, because we don't collect the money from investors, put it into a bucket, and then we make our decisions where we put the investors' money. There's no black box like in a usual venture capital fund. With SQVest, our investors, they can decide by themselves in which deal do they want to participate. So we are a deal-by-deal venture capital platform. This would be the exact term that we can use as well.
And can you maybe just share a little bit more about how the crowdfunding worked before and why did you decide to pivot from that? Because it does sound like an innovative, different approach to what we see.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? It always sounds good. Crowd investing sounds so fun. It sounds perfect. We democratize venture capital. That was the slogan. And it is something very nice and it's a good thing to do. But then at the end, it's a business and we need to function as a business. We need to create value for our investors and also for ourselves to sustain the business. And we've been trying this so hard for many years in the past, and it just didn't really work out. And let me tell you why. We're investing in a very narrow niche with healthcare. Okay. So we invest in companies like Vivior, right? Michael will probably explain a little bit more about what Vivior does. And those are niche products. Not everyone knows about them, and they're super interesting and exciting, but it's not something that you can put usually on Kickstarter or somewhere else where you can find some money from individuals, from retail investors. So people like you and me that just want to spend 250 euros, 1000 euros maybe for a quick win. It's not the product that you can capture with this kind of investing. Because of this, because healthcare is just not the perfect fit for crowd investing, we decided after many years that we should transition away from there and move towards the more professional investors that can also bring a lot more benefit, to be honest, to the companies that we have in our portfolio as well. Both ways work pretty good. Okay, they do. And the crowd investing was good as well. And it also made us invest in great companies like Vivio, for example. So we had successful deals that we did in the past, but we just decided, it was a tough decision, but we just decided at one point, if SQS wants to be successful and grow as a startup as well, we need to make this transition away from the crowd investing to more professional investors.
So Vivio entered SQS when it was still a crowdfunding platform.
It did, actually. It was just on the verge, basically. So yeah, we've been in this transition in the last 1-2 years. And that's when we also had VVR as a campaign on our website. So yeah.
Michael, what was the experience like? You look like you've got a lot to add to that.
No, it's because we recognized there is a transition happening and we had to communicate with SQS, where they're extremely supportive and really helpful, was with different stakeholders and different investor groups in the background, starting from the crowdfunding platform to the group they have, 10X Health Club, which is an investment group towards their institutional investors. So we got the whole portfolio of potential investors that we had to communicate to. And that was to some level a bit of a challenge because everyone has different expectations, different views, different investment strategies. And that was a little bit challenging. And I think with the transition SQS has done, I think that makes it clearer for also the startups to get a clearer process implemented.
Simon, 18 companies have currently raised money with the help of SQS. Can you share a little bit more about how you assess startups, how you look for them? One way is for startups to just apply through the form that's on the website. You're also working tightly with EIT Health to see what kind of companies they have on their radar. So how can companies reach out to you? The majority of companies does still come from Germany.
That's true. Yeah. The majority comes from the DACH region, so the German speaking part, even though we see quite some change right now as well there, because we have the past 2 or 3 investments are from Israel, by the way, which is the only country outside of the European Union that we also put in our mix of startups. We didn't have that earlier, but now Israel is part as well, because there are just great opportunities out down there and great companies. But you already mentioned it, EIT helped us a lot in the past years as well, by providing us access to the database they have, because they have a lot of startups in there. And we are able to screen the database as well from there. And also EIT can spread the word, right, in their network that SQVest is the specialized investment partner for you if you are a digital health company or a healthcare startup. And EIT helped us a lot there. And then also, it's just word of mouth. I told you, like, SQS exists since 2014, and over the years, it's an established brand in the niche. So if you want to do healthcare investments and you Google a little bit or you ask people in the scene, it's possible that you hear about SQS. They find us on LinkedIn, they find us through friends and word of mouth, and they apply through the website. And then there's a small portion also where we can reach out to potential deals, which is something that doesn't happen a lot, to be honest. If we find a really good startup somewhere, a really good deal, we can also approach the company and ask them for if they are interested to get funding. Yeah.
And are you limiting yourself to the special stage the startups are in? So who do you invest in most?
Yeah, we currently are looking more into the later stage deals, to be honest. So right now we are not investing anymore in early stage venture capital deals. We are more in serious A to B, I would say, even B. This is where we are right now from an investment round perspective. And then obviously the geographic focus is there. So we are investing mainly in European startups, and Israel is part of this in our understanding. So there's this as well. And after they pass those criteria, then our investment relation team and also our investment committee comes into play, and they have to assess the deals that passed the first criteria.
Michael, you have an interesting role because on the one hand, SQVest invested in Vivior, but you're also a member of the investment committee. So can you elaborate a little bit more about on the relationship between the two companies? When did you become the investment committee member?
I got investment committee member about 1.5 years ago. I think actually before I applied with Vivior, I got investment company, investment group review member. And I'm always excited to look at technology that potentially can impact patients' life, because that's what I did the last 30 years. And it was fascinating what high quality projects come into the platform. And sometimes I also recognized is that excellent project, at least from my view, made it sometimes quite complicated to explain their business model. And I think that's a little bit of an issue if you're in healthcare, is sometimes the explanation of how things work is not that simple. And I think that's where I think the sweet spot of EscoWest is, because they have these experts that can look on the healthcare opportunity from different points of view, whether it's in digital space or, in, for example, an implant. And I think that's the benefit if you approach an investor group or a VC with that deep know-how. From the role itself is, you know, at the beginning, I saw an increase in applications over the last months. And to be honest, is, you know, if you want to dive deep into these applications, it's very time consuming. So I think if I would something do different that I did before is I would make that application much more crisp and clear and simple, rather than trying to put all the information that I was thinking I have to put. So I think recognizing myself is I have more the tendency on looking on projects where I get the idea very quickly, I get the team very quickly, and I really get clearly where the project stands.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's also the challenge with startup pitches and competitions, where there's just so many applications and very quickly various solutions can sound the same. So it's difficult to review them. But speaking of expertise and the importance of having experts in the group, you're actually an engineer in physics, you are a doctor of theoretical medicine and entrepreneur in the ophthalmic and vision care industry, and you have over 25 national and international patents. So before we dive into what Vivior does, can you just share with us a little bit what kind of technologies in the field of ophthalmology devices did you develop in the past by today?
So I got into medical technologies in 92, about 30 years ago, working for a company that did medical laser systems. And I was very fascinated with the idea of doing lasers for something good for patients. And then I did my PhD in that space, in medical physics, theoretical medicine, with using lasers for eye surgery. And for me, the eye has a fascinating element, because 80% of our senses are coming through the eyes. And if we can help patients to see better, that's always very rewarding for everyone involved in the business. Over these years, I was involved very strongly in laser eye surgery, short sight, far sightness correction with a company called Wavelight out of Erlangen. We went end of the 90s to an IPO. We almost went bankrupt in 2007 with a big exit to a big strategic. So I followed them over more than 25 years. I've done all the hurdles. Then I started my own first company in 2005. That was a device drug combination, which I took from the research lab at the university towards your first commercialization international. I sold the company in 2011. They did an IPO with 350 million and then got it acquired for 750 million by a big strategic. So I have gone this ways of pathways. I got bored after the exits. I started a company in Dublin where we took technology from university. It's an eye diagnostic device for cataract surgery. We flipped that into a product in 28 months and sold it to a strategic. So that was a really quick one. And currently, I have two companies I'm associated with. One is a company that makes corneal implants made of human collagen in Boston. And there we are now in the path of getting commercial in Europe and doing FDA clinical trials. We're just in the process of closing the Series B funding. And then Vivior, of course, which is a digital health platform, where we're analyzing office workers and people that are exposed to a lot of computer vision system syndrome and to digital eye strain. And that's a kind of a growing disease. I wouldn't say call it a pandemic yet, but it pretty much didn't exist, that problem, before 2005. And I don't want to blame Apple for that, but since about 2005, we see a major increase in digital screen-associated vision, then, of course, you know, muscular problems, neck, back pain, and also reductions in the cardiovascular activities. And that's summarized as a topic like digital eye strain, or in some countries it's called computer vision syndrome, and it's on massive growth. Today, about 60% of all office workers complain about some sort of digital eye strain. Okay. And with Vivio, we developed a technology, a digital help wearable sensor to analyze the problem and to provide solutions for office workers.
Okay, so just to clarify, when we're talking about digital visual stress, which is what Vivior is trying to solve, we are talking about the broad problem connected to screens, because in the clinical term, visual stress refers to a very specific sensitivity to visual patterns, particularly stripes. So I just wanted to clarify what exactly do we mean when we talk about the digital visual stress.
Yeah, so digital visual stress means is if you go back into literature about 10 years, people were arguing, oh, you should not sit longer than 7 hours in front of a computer. And the monitor has to have this height and this light conditions. And there were loose guidance, hasn't changed over the last years. There's no pretty much no change since the introduction of monitors. Now, if you look today, we wake up in the morning, first thing is we look at our iPhones or cell phones. The next thing is we're having breakfast. Meanwhile, we're working on our iPad, some movies. Then we go to work. We're spending 8-9 hours in front of digital screens. And then at home, we're enjoying the world of Netflix, for example, and other platforms. So our screen time has increased massively. And that has consequences in adults, mainly on the eye problem. You're getting dry eye because you have a reduced blinking rate. You have problems with neck and back pain and you less of cardiovascular activities. Now, in children, what we see is a massive growth of what is called myopia. More and more children are getting short-sightedness. We have a growth rate of about 8% per year globally. And the World Health Organization expects that in 2050, more than half of the population will be short-sighted. And that's because we're spending more time close by. And with Vivio, we can understand your behaviors, how much time you spend. We can help you to identify optical solutions, as well as to organize your workplace, your environment, to make it more comfortable, to increase well-being, and in the long term, to give you better health.
So let's dive into how Vivior works. It's a wearable sensor that is put on eyeglasses that can be provisional in case the person doesn't wear eyeglasses. And the sensor just captures various types of data. However, it doesn't have a camera, it doesn't have a microphone, and it doesn't measure individuals' location. So how exactly does it work?
Yeah, my background is, and maybe this is a very technical term, is, it's called OCT, optical coherence tomography. And the technology is pretty much very similar than what people are using today in self-driving cars. There's little lasers inside, they're permanently measuring distance. And if you have a scanner or if you drive around with your car, you're scanning your environment. And that means you're getting information about distances at various locations. What we are doing is we put in motion sensors in this little device and we put in these distance sensors. And by just your body motion, by walking around, sitting around, by your activities, we can actually recognize what you're looking at. If you look at the monitor, if you look at the cell phone, if you look at a TV or if you're outside, inside. So we're getting what we call a visual behavior pattern. And that's very typical for individuals. The classical pattern is if you look at the cell phone, what happens? You bring your phone 20, 30 centimeters close by, your neck goes down 20 degrees, and your whole body freezes because you're concentrated on your phone. And that's what we're seeing as a typical pattern. Now we can translate that in suggestions of how to help you. One is a comprehensive report that gives you recommendation how to adjust your monitor and height, light conditions, break times, which increases and helps with your blink rate. That's one element. The other element, we can give eye care professionals like opticians information about how to make your office glasses that will help to relax your eye during the work. And the third thing is we can give you recommendations on, for example, implement a walking desk, implement or reduce your blue light exposure. Because a lot of these LED lights we're using today or the monitors have a high exposure to blue light. And that will help you to increase your well-being, your sleeping patterns. So that's a holistic approach, how we can help someone based on the Vivio data.
And who do you mostly sell to? Is it more a B2B or a B2C approach?
We started off with a B2B approach to opticians. And you know, because they are usually people, when people come in to the optician saying, hey, I have burning, itchy eyes, my eyes are tired when I look at the monitor, these are usually the first point of contact. So we built now a network in Germany and in Switzerland with opticians. And now we're just launching our B2C approach, where in the first step, we're actually going to the employers and offer the employers help for their employees. And of course, we're going directly through social media to B2C. But we first had to establish a channel of or a network of opticians that we train, that they have access to our technology, and that they actually trained on helping patients on this new holistic approach.
Can you take us through the development process of the Vivio wearable sensor? You talked about it a little bit, but still, how did you decide what's going to be included in the sensor and the measurements that are taken into account? And how is this like a finalized product? To which extent is it still undergoing further improvements based on research?
So for me, coming out of classical medtech, where everything is a waterfall project and very rigid development, Vivio is very exciting because we have established development cycles much faster. And is, I think if you do something into digital health or if you do something in wearable sensing, you have to think about how can I faster adapt to the market needs and be quicker, because it's not a classical medical device that then at some point is reimbursed. You have much more user input. So that was a big learning for us. So the way we approached it is we went out to our family and friends, the eye doctors. We gave them prototypes, you know, let them play with that. We got feedback, we iterated. And now we are actually working on what we call Mark V, which I think in reality is now pretty much the 10th generation. And we had to adapt through different business models. We had to adapt through various feedbacks from users, either from clinicians or from patients. And I think if I would have done it, have to redo it again, I would even increase that focus of being much more agile in this development and having that much more budgeted, because it's essential for this type of product.
Are you certified and defined as a medical device? Because that can have a huge impact on just the whole business side of the sensor and the company.
Exactly. We have a version where we are as a medical device regulated. But to be honest, the market told us that it deserves potentially also for a non-medical device, which is more like a Fitbit or a training system. So we're actually working now on a model outside of the medical device space, because exactly what you just said, in medical device space, your development cycles are tough. If you want to increase them because of the regulations, if you get outside of that, that can be much quicker. But it is a fine line that you have to be very clear with the regulators if you're inside or outside a medical device. But as of today, we are a medical device.
Simon, you want to add a more general comment here in regards to what perhaps you as an investment company look at in startups when it comes to clinical proof and clinical data, and whether or not a company has a device that's certified as an MDR, because what with the digital health market maturing, what we now see is a growing demand for the solutions to be clinically validated, to have clinical trials behind them. And that's, in essence, a really huge potential strain for the startups, because clinical trials take time and are expensive.
Yeah, it is. And it is a very delicate space, I would call it, because companies do say a lot, but the question is, first, can they deliver? And second, will they deliver? And clinical trials are crucial in the phases that we are also investing in our companies, depending on the business model. Obviously, not every business might need one, but in most businesses, they are required for us to actually see, get a proof of concept early enough, that also everything the company claims has something behind it. So it is definitely something that we are also keen on and we're looking for
We talked about the current landscape of digital health and the sentiment around investments and how that's changing. But I wonder if you try to take an even another step back to get a bigger picture of how digital health is actually changing healthcare. The interesting question is, are the healthcare systems getting more efficient, and to which extent can we really claim, based on the technologies that already have been implemented, that digital health is improving healthcare? What are your kind of observations around that?
Maybe I can start. I would say what is the expectation of digitalization is getting broader access, democratize healthcare, getting data shared, and so forth. I don't think we have achieved that yet. I don't think so. I think we're on a track, we're on a pathway there, and I think it's definitely kind of a holy grail to move this pathway. Where I do see over the last years of digitalization, especially the last 10 years, that has brought us today, a healthcare system or a clinic cannot function without any. It's impossible. You need to have the same information at the same point, at the same time for everyone involved in the process. Now, I think we're very good there yet. However, what I hear from clinicians is it got very complex. There's an overload of information. Hoping to go into see over the next years is where digitalization can help is making the data more easier to interpret. In what way or ever, if we talk AI or something, you probably know all of the fancy words, but I think at the end of it, make it easier for the clinician. I think the big challenge to come is we're going to have not enough clinicians to serve all the patients that are coming. And I think we're going to see, especially in the Western countries, still the age pyramid to grow, with people walking more and more into a healthcare situation where they need help. And we see a decline relatively of healthcare providers, either starting from the nurses to the technicians and, of course, the clinicians. And I think where digital health technology has to help is managing that situation. Otherwise, it will be a failure. And that's, on the other hand, where I really believe we can help.
I want to just underline everything Michael said there, but also just emphasize the importance of dealing with all the data, because like Michael said, it's just getting a lot of data out there. Everyone wants to collect data and everyone knows, okay, patient data is also something very valuable. We need to store and collect it safely and also in a legal correct form, which comes with a ton of problems, also depending on where is the company based and which regulatory frame is surrounding this. So there are a lot of problems to solve in this new digitalized healthcare space. But I just think that humans are good at solving problems. We did that the past centuries, and I think we're going to do this, especially right now, especially in this age where we live right now, with all the data, with all the technology. It's just even accelerated. So in my opinion, or in our opinion, what we saw in the past 10, 20 years, we're going to probably see in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's just getting quicker. The healthcare industry as well, which is known to be slow because of the regulatory framework, but it's going to be accelerating and we're going to solve the problems quicker. And we're going to find ways as well to use the data that we're collecting already right now.
You've been listening to Faces of Digital Health, a proud member of the Health Podcast Network. If you enjoyed the show, do leave a rating or a review wherever you get your podcast, because it really, really helps other listeners interested in digital health find the show as well. Stay tuned!